So proponents of demanding those objections argue that moral theories that ask too much from agents must be given up or revised. The recent debate has extended the challenge of demanding those objections in two ways. First, by discussing all sorts of ethical theories and not only consequentialism, so they now discuss constructivism, deontology, and virtue ethics. Second, the current debate is not focused anymore on the demands of beneficence, but discusses a wide range of moral requirements in different areas, for example, in medical ethics regarding future generations or refugees. So this recent expansion of the debate makes it even more important to clarify the meaning and potency of the demanding those objections. What exactly is the difference that the objection enables us to see or make? So here is a typical demanding this case in which an agent has to sacrifice his own well-being in order to comply with a moral requirement. So here's the case I came up that somehow covers what I have in mind. Bernard, a big opera fan, is willing to sacrifice something in order to help the poor. But he also believes that there is a limit to the sacrifice that he has to make. Despite the clarity and firmness of his belief that this limit exists, he struggles to pinpoint where it is. Is it already excessive to ask him to sacrifice a single trip to Verona? After all, opera is one of his life-enhancing ground projects. Or does he not reach the limit, even if he completely stops spending money on opera, because he can watch it online for free? Hoping for some guidance, Bernard turns to the literature that advocates demanding his objections. He reads that compliance with a moral requirement should not make his well-being drop, quote, below a certain minimum, or that it should not be, quote, too great a burden, or that his sacrifice should not be too big a reduction in the agent's good, or that his sacrifice should not be out of proportion to the benefit. Bernard is puzzled. How can these definitions help him to find the exact limit for him? Rumor has that Bernard later turned to be an anti-theorist. It seems that theories in favor of demanding these objections inform us what type of limit matters, but not when exactly a requirement becomes overly demanding. In consequence, they fail to shape their addressees' decisions and actions. But since Socrates, there is a guidance constraint, a norm for evaluating ethical theories, according to which ethical theories are better to the extent that they provide adequate moral guidance. I have three claims about this. In the first part, I argue that demanding these objections fail to define over-demanding these sharply because they are vague. That is Sorites susceptible. In a slogan, over-demandingness is a heap. In the second part, I will discuss two attempts to bypass the problem of vagueness and argue that they are not very successful. And in the final part, I will conclude that we should embrace the vagueness and acknowledge that the objection cannot provide exact guidance, but that these objections nonetheless can be plausible and give some rough guidance. I will presuppose that there are plausible objections, actual or possible, because my aim is to point to problems that we face once we make the decision to endorse the objection and then draw some conclusions for various fields. Let me start with a couple of preparatory remarks. First, I have no special concept of vagueness. consider the widely shared view by Bryce. Quote, to say that an expression is vague is to say that there are cases, actual or possible, in which one does not know whether to apply the expression or to withhold it. Vagueness is a challenge to the classical view that all concepts draw sharp lines, so that one can always and exactly classify things. Frege's sharpness requirement says that concepts need to be sharp in order to be meaningful concepts at all. According to this classical view, over-demandingness needs to be sharply defined, meaning that the compliance with a certain requirement is either over-demanding for a certain agent in a given situation, or it is not. If this classical conception, however, does not apply to the objection, there will be borderline cases in which we cannot say if a requirement is excessive or not. My aim is to show that demandingness objections are vague. I will not provide a deeper discussion of what explains the vagueness of the expression. I can set this aside because the major theories of vagueness all agree on a definition of vagueness. The three major theories of ontic, epistemic, or semantic vagueness differ only when it comes to explain why there is vagueness. I will say something about epistemic vagueness in part two, though. Second, I need to say what I take to be vague about the objection. So, what is the vague expression in question? It's very important to note that the objection does not object to demandingness in general or to all levels of demandingness, however low. Most moral theories assume that morality can ask something from us. Demandingness objections concern only cases in which the demandingness is above a certain limit. According to Scheffler, the question is how to react when an otherwise plausible normative theory makes unusually heavy demands of individual agents, for Scheffler. Thus, demandingness objections imply a distinction between acceptable or reasonable levels of demandingness and unacceptable or unreasonable levels, which are classified as excessive, asking too much, overly demanding, and so on. And this concept about the threshold when the over-demandingness starts, this is what I take to be vague. So, I will follow the classical way to show that an expression is vague, and that is the heap paradox, which runs as follows. One grain of sand clearly is not a heap. If we add one grain, this still does not make a heap. When repeating this step multiple times, no single addition makes the difference with regard to the number of grains that we classify as a heap and the number that we do not call a heap. Hence, we will end up with millions of grains, but not a heap. So here's a first glance on what the objection would look like if we consider over-demandingness to be a heap. Asking for the smallest possible sacrifice from an affluent agent, say 1 cent, clearly is not overly demanding. Increasing the demandingness by asking for another cent still does not count as over-demanding. When repeating this step multiple times, it is unclear which step makes the difference between acceptable demandingness and excessive demandingness. We end up with demanding everything that never will be asking too much. So, final remark is that such an application of the heap paradox requires that two conditions are met. We need an ordering of values on one dimension decisive for the predicate's application, like the number of grains n, and we also need the tolerance of the allegedly vague predicate. So let us have a closer look at these two conditions. In order to see why demandingness objections meet the first condition, consider the three mainstream accounts of the objection. These three mainstream accounts say that acceptable demandingness becomes over-demandingness if compliance with a moral requirement reduces the agent's well-being below an absolute threshold T, that's the threshold view. Second, compliance reduces the agent's well-being by a loss L, that is too big, that's the loss view. And third, if compliance does not yield a benefit that is R times higher than the cost to the agent, that's Scheffler's relational view. All theories define over-demandingness according to a gradable aspect on one dimension, the level of the agent's well-being after compliance, the magnitude of the cost, or the ratio of cost and benefit. It's important to note that the variables are part of what we find in the literature and not something that I have added in order to give a generalized description. Scheffler, for instance, argues that the benefit to others should be n times as great as the net loss to the agent. But in most cases, the variables are more or less hidden in phrases like below a certain minimum, too big a reduction in the agent's good, or too great a burden. The variables explain the lack of guidance, because without knowing T, L, or R, we cannot decide if the compliance leads to something below or above T, L, and R. Now, Brett Hooker has claimed that the variables can be easily fleshed out, but this has not been done so far. If demandingness objections are indeed vague, we know why it has not been done, because it cannot be done. So here's the more important second condition. The heat paradox requires not only a gradable value on one dimension, for example, the number of grains n. The second condition is tolerance, meaning that there is no number n that allows the assertion n does not make a heap, but n plus 1 does. Wright has another way to put this. The predicate F is, quote, tolerant with respect to P if there is also some positive degree of change in respect of P, insufficient ever to affect the justice with which F applies to a particular case. Three aspects are important here. There is a value on a fine-grained local and incremental level. For instance, the number of grains n. Second, there is the vague predicate, for example, heap, which needs to be a coarse predicate on a global or categorical level. And third, there are cases in which a marginal difference regarding the fine-grained volume, local value on a dimension cannot be said to make a difference on the global categorical level, calling it a heap or not. Now, very important that the smallness here is decisive. If the difference between two steps is big enough, let's say 1 grain of sand and 5 million, then this step makes the vagueness vanish. The difference because the first step and the second step, the 5 million grains, that also is the difference between a non-heap and a heap. However, this step would not get us any closer to finding a sharp boundary because it is somewhere between 1 and 5 million, which is not a very sharp assumption. So the tolerance becomes visible only if we acknowledge the smallness of the steps. So, and with demandingness, we have all three steps, all three aspects. First, consider the fine grain value, like the number of grains n, demandingness d, is not only gradable on a single dimension, it is also fine grained. As mentioned, we can increase an unquiet sacrifice cent by cent. Second, just like the distinction between heap and non-heap, demandingness objection use a coarse or categorical distinction between those levels of demandingness that are reasonable and those that are taken to be too high, excessive and therefore overly demanding. Third, the relation between the fine-grained steps of demandingness and the coarse distinction between acceptable and excessive demandingness is crucial. If we cannot say that requiring a certain donation is overly demanding, how can we say that a minimally increased donation means asking too much? So without the ability to find the step that makes us change the application of the expression overly demanding, we cannot provide a sharply defined definition of overdemandingness. And it seems that even those who think overdemandingness objections are plausible cannot get exact guidance from them. And so, how can we apply the objection in various fields of practical ethics? So this is why I now turn to two attempts to bypass the vagueness to get guiding statements. The first attempt is based on a specific explanation of vagueness, namely the epistemic account. The hallmark of the epistemic explanation is to argue that sharp boundaries exist in reality, but that we do not know them. This is quite attractive. Recall that vagueness threatens our classical views, including bivalence, by denying that sharp boundaries exist. And the epistemic theory of vagueness is more in line with the classical view by assuming that vagueness is a purely epistemic phenomenon. It arises only from us not knowing about the existing boundaries. So tolerance, what I have described as tolerance, is viewed by the epistemic account as our margin of error. Epistemic vagueness regarding demandingness objection assumes that there really is an exact number of straws that breaks the camel's neck, only that we do not know about that exact number. Now, in what way can this theory be used to bypass the problem of vagueness so that we can make guiding judgments regarding alleged overdemandingness? So I now draw on an argument that I found in one of the five, there are about five German utilitarianists or so. So one of them, Bernhard Gesang, who was here also a couple of years ago, he found the argument that I present now in his book on utilitarianism to make in a most explicit way. I think it's at work in Anglophone literature as well, but I draw on the most explicit account. So here's the argument. So this is D and it rises, and let's assume we have a sharp boundary, but that sharp boundary is clouded by our margin of error, the fuzzy zone. So and then the claim is, oh well, if it's about a case that lies here or here, then we can make clear-cut assumptions. So I have two comments on this strategy. The first one is not necessarily a criticism, but I think it's worth pointing out that the theory of epistemic vagueness has serious implications. Epistemic vagueness is often discussed with regard to natural entities. I take it that the existence of sharp boundaries regarding the natural world is less controversial as in ethics. Tom Doherty has a very fine paper on vague value, and there he plausibly argues that in ethics, epistemic vagueness implies a robust realism, according to which the difference between plausible demandingness and over-demandingness would refer to a sharply defined entity in reality independent from us. So adopting this strategy and adopting the epistemic account might involve some very strong meta-ethical views that you not were inclined earlier on. So it will be worth knowing that you imply a controversial meta-ethical claim. So, but that's just a remark, not necessarily a criticism. Maybe you like robust realism. Now to the second, more critical remark. Let us grant the two key assumptions of this strategy, namely that a sharp boundary exists and that we cannot know it because it's clouded by our margin of error, the fuzzy zone. Now, if that is correct, we certainly want to know where our ignorance starts and ends. So what we need to know is these two boundaries. Only if we know about these two boundaries, the upper and lower limit of the margin of error, then we would be sure if we are talking about a case that lies above or below. So the irony of this strategy is that epistemic vagueness is all about explaining vagueness by ignorance, but the strategy presupposes additional knowledge about the sharp limits of the margin of error. And I think it's not possible to have that knowledge because there is the problem of second-order vagueness. There is second-order vagueness because the limits of the margin of error are sororities susceptible themselves. If we cannot know and discern where the sharp boundary between acceptable demandingness and over-demandingness is, how can we know where the margin of error starts and ends? The problem remains the same if we cannot say that the level of demandingness is the limit of over-demandingness. We cannot say that a certain level of demandingness, D, lies outside the margin of error, but D plus 1 lies within. But that's what we would need to know in order to know where that lower limit is. So, the epistemic account does not solve the problem of tolerance by interpreting it as a margin of error. Because on closer inspection, the problem of tolerance also applies to the boundaries of the margin of error. The epistemic account just shifts the problem to the higher order instead of solving it. In the words of Timothy Williamson, quote, the difficulty of applying the higher order classifications to a sorority series is of just the same kind as the difficulty of applying the first order classification, which was what led us to recognize the problem with vagueness in the first place. Thus, higher order vagueness is a problem for all who claim to know the boundaries of the margin of error. And this leads to an overconfidence when it comes to know whether a certain requirement is clearly above or below the margins. So much for the first attempt. Now to the second one. Can intuition tell us if a moral requirement for a certain agent in a certain situation is overly demanding or not? For example, in my initial case, we seem to be justified in saying that we can't require Bernard to sacrifice a single trip to the opera without asking too much. Likewise, we might say that our intuition tells us that the 1% pledge that Peter Singer discusses in The Life You Can Save is not overly demanding. This strategy has a big advantage, but it also has two limitations. Let's start with the advantage. Intuition, unlike deductive forms of reasoning, yields straightforward verdicts, whether the compliance with a specific moral requirement is overly demanding or not. So there's nothing wrong with deductive arguments, and they are quite helpful in many ways. For example, when a plausible drinking water guideline recommends that the level of copper in drinking water should be less than 2 mg/L to prevent any health-related problems, we test our water, then we know if the tested water is above or below the limit, and then we can act accordingly. Now, if my claim about the vagueness of the objection is correct, then this kind of deductive argument is not available to us, because the vagueness prevents us from having a premise with a specific upper limit of demandingness. And without that, the deductive argument is not taking off. Intuitions have the advantage that they do not need such a premise with a specific upper limit. Peter Singer, for example, argues that the 1% pledge is clearly not over-demanding. He says it would not require wealthy people to come remotely near to impoverishing themselves, end quote. I take it that our intuition backs Singer's claim like they back the claim that one grain of sand clearly is not a heap. So the advantage is that claims like Singer's are exact enough and guiding without having to define the threshold to overdemandingness. He can ignore if it exists or does not exist. He does not have to say where it is, if it exists, and so on. He does not have to say when impoverishment starts. Nor does he have to define the margin of error, which was the problem with the first strategy. So far, so good, and here's the but. My first concern is that the advantage I just described also is a disadvantage from the viewpoint of the objection. I'm now shifting the perspective. So what I've done so far is from the perspective of Peter Singer, saying, well, I propose everybody gives 1%, not overly demanding, fine. That's fine also from the perspective of many of the objection. But if we now change perspective to proponents of the objection, we would like to know where the limit is, if it exists. As said, Peter Singer is not defining any limit, and he doesn't have to be. So this strategy that he proposes is no strategy in finding, is not a contribution for the task of the objection to find the limit. Making an individual claim about the alleged over-demandingness of one single requirement is something very different from defining the threshold between acceptable and excessive levels of demandingness. Intuitions are not able to overcome, that's my suspicion, to sidestep or overcome the problem of tolerance. Because demandingness is so fine-grained, we would need intuitions for two neighboring levels of demandingness, which tell us that the lower level is acceptable and the higher over-demandingness. We would need intuition for that. I do not know any attempt to try to do this. I'm afraid so. That is because the smaller the steps are, the more controversial and unstable our intuition will get. If that is correct, intuitions, even if they can inform and guide us regarding individual cases, they cannot help us to establish a theory of the threshold, but that is the backbone of the objection. So now to the second limitation. Intuitions seem to work fine in cases of low demandingness, like Singer's 1% pledge. It's easy to see why they work well in these cases. As said, all plausible accounts of morality agree that morality can ask us to sacrifice something. And this matches the intuitions about the low cases, namely that they are not cases of excessive requirements. It's simply morality's job to tell us to sacrifice this. But what about all the cases with higher demandingness? Take, for example, the following case. Self, I'm trapped with White in slowly collapsing wreckage. I can save either White's life or my leg. So let me ask, who thinks that the person can be required to sacrifice a leg for a life? Who thinks that? No one? Who thinks that this is overly demanding? Couple of people are undecided. So, of course, some of you might have noticed it's Parfit's case. So, two interesting things about what Parfit has to say about the case. So, his position is, quote, the cost here would be too great. And also, I would be morally permitted to save my leg. So, here comes the interesting two aspects of Parfit's discussion. First, Parfit acknowledges the possibility of conflicting views. He writes, on some views, I ought save White's life rather than my leg, since White's loss would be much greater than mine. Now, the other interesting thing is, he says, most of us have a different view. Parfit takes it to be the view of the majority without explaining what majority it is and how he gets that empirical claim from. Without explaining this, he claims that the majority thinks that requiring to save a life or a leg is asking too much. But it's important that he discusses conflicting views. Of course, I will not be able to solve the disagreement. I don't even want to solve that disagreement. I just want to point out that the literature is full of cases with higher demandingness, where lots of people like Shelley Kagan and others and Sobel say, well, this is high demandingness, but this is not overly demanding. So I would like to point that high demandingness is way more controversial. So in sum, it seems that intuitions are a solution only with regard to cases of low levels of demandingness. They are not much help when it comes to finding the threshold. And thirdly, they might be more in conflict when it comes to cases of higher demandingness. So the strategy gives us something, especially if you are, like Peter Singer, not interested in working out the objection, you just want to do practical ethics. Then the strategy is very good. If you would like to be interested, if you are interested in other questions, then the strategy doesn't work so well. So, conclusions. I have three of them. First, we should be careful about the way we talk about demandingness objections and better not give the impression that the problem of vagueness is not serious and can be overcome. We are facing absolute vagueness and not some relative vagueness. That is vagueness with regard to contingent ignorance, maybe ignorance in form of pending research on demandingness objections or some empirical knowledge regarding a specific case. Second, I think it would be an overreaction to argue that if demandingness objections are vague, then they should be given up. This argument has some initial plausibility as it takes the vagueness serious and then applies vagueness sharpness requirement. Accordingly, one might argue that if demandingness objections are vague, it is unclear what they are about, and then they should be given up. I reject this view, not because I fear that the rigorous application of vagueness sharpness principle would make most of us lose our jobs. Lack of exact guidance is a problem, but besides guidance, there are other additional criteria that might make the demandingness objection look worthwhile. For example, there are some implications for meta-ethical debates, like the relation of morality and our personal well-being, or more specifically, how we weigh moral reasons against non-moral reasons, or the problem of supererogation. All these debates can profit from drawing on the demandingness objection, even if the concept of over-demandingness remains to be vague. Now to my final conclusion. Vagueness does not allow for exact guidance, but what about lowering our expectations? The suggestion is to embrace vagueness. Bernard Williams in Ethics and the Limits of Philosophy famously argued that our conceptual framework should fit our ethical lives, which he takes to be very messy. Therefore, he concludes ethics is likely to be an, quote, untidy business. And that implies using vague concepts. So some might say that Williams just repeats what Aristotle says in the Ethics, namely that we should not expect more exactness in a discipline than the subject matter allows for. Others might interpret Williams to give a special explanation for the vagueness, namely ontic vagueness. Ontic vagueness assumes that moral reality does not have any sharp boundary and that this should be mirrored by our concepts. I'm not going to decide what's the correct interpretation of Williams here, because I would like to suggest something that is more about guidance. So I'm going to link Williams with Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein has pointed out that vague concepts can serve us quite well in practical affairs. In paragraph 71 of his Philosophical Investigations, he rejects Frege's view that only sharp boundaries make up useful concepts. Now, quote Wittgenstein, is it even always an advantage to replace an indistinct picture by a sharp one? Isn't the indistinct one often exactly what we need? Frege compares a concept to an area and says that an area with vague boundaries cannot be called an area at all. This presumably means that we cannot do anything with it. But is it senseless to say, stand roughly there? I suppose that I were standing with someone in a city square and said that. As I say it, I do not draw any kind of boundary, but perhaps point with my hand as if were I indicating a particular spot. So that was Wittgenstein. In this sense, vague demandingness objections might be useful, namely by roughly pointing to the vague limits to our moral obligations. But even given this rough guidance would require lots of extra work on demandingness objections that has not been done so far. So let's start climbing the heap.